Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to start with a very short reading prior to my talk. This is from the Zen Buddhist writer Thanissara Mary Weinberg. Anger is traditionally thought to be close to wisdom. When not projected outward onto others or inward toward the self, it gives us the necessary energy and clarity to understand what needs to be done. Gospel of climate change, because gospel means good news, and I want to discuss the hopeful news about climate change and renewable energy, because of that, this was almost a very short presentation. And this is, you know, I've done a presentation like this before and other presentations here at YEES, but this is one of the, I've had the hardest time getting motivated for this service, because we're getting new reports about climate change on a regular basis. And just since February 10th, when I was supposed to do this service, there's been much news about climate change. I wanted to have to point out the humorous irony of having the climate change presentation postponed because of snow. Winter's not done yet. But most of the reports in the last few months have not had a lot of good news. Because last fall, the UN's International Panel on Climate Change, you know, had a report where they put together all of their science and estimates, and that to keep the world warming from getting to be really bad and catastrophic, we need to, you know, greatly reduce our emissions within 12 years or 11 years now. So one of the interesting things I've noticed is that the good news that exists is often wrapped in contradictions and irony. The good news exists in things like solar power at night, or wind power when the wind doesn't blow, in businesses asking for taxes and regulations, and in students who skip school. And then also in, I just thought this was a little bit funny too, in a headline like the good news about renewable energy from the Department of Energy, which is of course run currently by Rick Perry from Texas, when he took the job, he thought Department of Energy was involved with promoting oil and gas. Speaking of fossil fuels, so coal energy, as we may remember, has been used since ancient times, you know, back in ancient China and other ancient civilizations. Petroleum The modern petroleum industry began in 1859 in Pennsylvania when a well was discovered there. And it's way past time for those fossil fuels to go the way of other out-of-date technologies like stone-tipped spears and the 8-track tape and make room for radically better technology. And so I could talk about how scientists at oil companies have known about the risks of climate change since at least the 1970s. And I could talk about the late climate scientist Stephen Schneider, who was a scientist at Stanford. And in around 1989 or 90, he visited my college and gave a presentation on climate change and how the science at that time was pretty sure we were warming the planet. And at that point, they didn't know exactly how much or how quickly or how bad it could be, but they knew it was warming and it could be bad and it might be really bad. And so at that, so he made the argument that reducing fossil fuel use would be like an insurance policy against the worst possible outcomes. Of course, he wasn't the only scientist at the time talking like that. So we have reasons to be angry. That's why I had that quote from the Buddhist writer about what anger is appropriate and how to appropriately point it. And also for despair, I think. And a certain amount of anger and despair, I think, is needed to really say, oh, yeah, we need to pay attention to this and do something. Because I'm just listening to a tape, a recording, a podcast of an environmentalist talking about the Green New Deal and, and how it could be really good. But he didn't quite talk, I think he was assuming his audience understood, but he wasn't quite making the argument of why it was so important and why we should be at least a little bit angry and have a little bit more despair and channel that. But I was trained by, as Jocelyn mentioned, the Climate Reality Project, founded by Al Gore, who around the time, 89 and 90, when I heard Stephen Schneider, Al Gore was also starting his environmental advocacy. And so we should deal with reality, climate reality, as it is today. And so I'm going to, I think a lot of folks here may have seen or remember some of the information, but I'm going to use some of my climate reality slides over there to kind of go over a few things quickly, sort of the bad news and the good news of climate change. And I will try to switch over. Be the roaming speaker here for a few minutes. Of course, this is our planet, taken by the Apollo astronauts. I think this is from the 1968 mission to the moon on Christmas Eve. And so the basics of climate science, which has been known for at least 100 years or so, since chemists are pretty smart people, sunlight comes in, warms up the planet, that's why we can live here. And the atmosphere acts as a blanket to warm things up and keep things warm, because planets that don't have a thick atmosphere like Mars or Mercury, they can get warm, but the heat immediately goes up back into space. Carbon dioxide and methane and a few other chemicals are especially good at holding in heat. And when you increase the amount of carbon dioxide and methane, less heat goes back out into space, and you have in effect, a thicker, more efficient blanket to keep the Earth a little bit warmer than it has been. And of course, there's our fun little cartoon of different ways that humans have been increasing carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere in the last 150 years since the petroleum industry started, with fossil fuel plants and cars and industries and transportation and concrete and shipping
And of course, forest fires, which we know in the West. So lots of ways we're dumping huge amounts of carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere. And this is a graph from the 1850s, you know, since that 1859 point in Titusville, Pennsylvania. The amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere has gone way, way up. And 110 million tons of pollution every day, that's, you know, a lot. And so, you know, some of that is absorbed back, but most of it is staying and warming. So the last 130 some years, you know, it shows the deviation from the average temperature. And of course, most of the warm years, almost all the warm years, are in the last 20 or 30 years. And the last few years have been very warm. So I think 2018, I think, was like maybe the fourth warmest on record. So not the warmest ever, but up number four. But the last several have been very warm. So we're inching towards, so we're beyond half a degree warm, inching towards 1 degree Celsius warmer than the historic average, which is warmer than it's been in a, basically since before human civilization developed. The ocean is absorbing a lot of this heat, so the oceans are getting much warmer. And the effects of this are starting to be seen more and more. Of the number, this is from the insurance industry. The insurance industry is very concerned about climate change since it costs them a lot of money. When you have increasing floods and storms and droughts and fires, you know, especially for example, when you have Paradise, California burning down, that's a, it's a human tragedy and also a huge financial tragedy. So we have hurricanes and floods. This is from India. So around the world, of course, most of the droughts and floods and fires and storms are disproportionately affecting, you know, lower income folks and folks who don't have the money to escape them. This is from Canada a couple years ago. Of course, this fire was very close to where the tar sands oils are being extracted in northern Canada, which is sadly ironic. Of course, food is sensitive to heat, and certain foods will have, you know, don't grow as well when it's a little bit warmer. Species are being threatened. So the good news we have is that the amount of wind turbines that we have are going increasing a huge amount, and so faster than people had thought. The cost of wind turbines is declining, so we can build more faster. The cost of wind compared to coal and oil is becoming very competitive, and same thing with solar. This is in Eastern Oregon somewhere. I believe near the Columbia River, where Eastern Oregon, like many other places in the U.S., is very windy, which is great for electricity. This is a fairly new kind of wind turbine that actually has a small battery built into it, so that it can store a small amount of electricity to so that when the wind's not blowing, it can help smooth out, even out the power in the grid. And so this is one of the sort of newer developments in wind technology for when the wind isn't blowing. This is a map of how windy it is in the U.S. The Midwest and Texas, especially, and the Dakotas are very windy, have, you know, huge amounts of wind potential. So even if Texas is pumping less oil, they have huge amounts of wind potential. The coast of Oregon, off the coast, is very windy, as you might have noticed if you go to the beach. Also, the east coast of the U.S. is extremely windy, and off the coast, close to where I grew up, I grew up in Massachusetts, but off the coast of Rhode Island is the first U.S.-based offshore wind project, where you have wind turbines in the shallow part of the ocean creating power, which has, you know, throughout the east and west coast, and the Gulf, there's lots of potential for that. Solar power is a similar story, where making solar power even just 10, 15 years ago was a lot more expensive than it is today. The number of solar panels being built and installed has gone way up, and that's the US and Germany, Japan, and there's China. China's production has gone through the roof because it's just become so much cheaper to install solar panels in the rest of the world. And so this is an example of when you have government encouraging solar power at an appropriate rate. So Chile, a couple years ago, you know, really amped up their encouragement and requirements for solar power. And so that's the potential of going from a little bit of solar power to, oh yeah, it's kind of a normal part of development in Chile now. And, you know, and part of that is government regulations, part of that is it's gotten a lot cheaper. And it makes a lot more sense for Chile to install solar power than to burn, to import coal or oil. And so that, you know, that is the potential for much of the world. Solar power has huge advantages in, you know, poor villages that aren't on the grid. This is in Spain, which is of course very sunny, where you have solar power, solar, you know, pointing at a central point to create electricity. This is a plant in Arizona. So this is your solar power at night, where during the day this plant can produce power, but it has a kind of battery using salt, where during the daytime the heat and energy from the solar panels stores heat in giant underground tanks of salt and turns the salt into a molten consistency. And so that at night, the heat stored in the salt is then used to create electricity for up to 6 hours, so that this plant can produce power, you know, almost 24 hours a day from the stored energy. And so there's a couple of different versions of this around the world, where the problems of, you know, nighttime or cloudy days, you know, can be solved. And this is an example of solar capacity, because Germany is a world leader in solar power. But Germany is about as sunny as Alaska or British Columbia, and they have a lot more solar power than the U.S. does right now. And so much of the U.S., including much of Oregon, has a lot more potential than Germany. And, you know, and even Eastern Oregon is as good or better than Germany for solar potential. For some places in the world, like in Iceland, you have geothermal power, which can help be very efficient where that is available. Another potential for Oregon is ocean power from waves and tides. And so these are a couple of examples of underwater generating capacity, where you put this turbine underwater to be powered by the forces of tides. On the left is another tidal power system that was installed off the coast of Maine, so that as the tide comes in, electricity is created. The nice thing about tidal power is that it's very regular. You know when it's going to happen, so you know how much power you'll be getting. And so those are in development, not as far advanced as solar and wind, but again, lots of potential. A couple years ago, there was a huge march in Washington and other cities. People are more aware of calling for climate change, but maybe not as much as needed to get attention from some people. But this is where I think a lot of the hope lies now. This is Greta Thunberg. Do not be surprised if in a couple years she wins the Nobel Prize. She's from Stockholm, Sweden. And her quote there, if you can't see it, so she's 16 years old. I think that photo there was when she was 15, I think. And this quote here from when she was giving a speech at a meeting in Europe: "I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic and act as if the house was on fire." And so Greta, she was inspired, somewhat ironically, by the shooting last year, last February, in Parkland, Florida, when she saw, these students in Florida become very active and, you know, lead nationwide marches regarding climate change, regarding school shootings, and taking action about that. And so she saw climate change as an important issue. And so in one of her essays that she's written, she wrote, "I remember thinking it was very strange that we are capable of changing the entire face of the earth and the precious layer, thin layer of atmosphere that makes it our home. Because if we were capable of doing this, then why weren't we hearing about it everywhere? As soon as you turned on the television, why wasn't the climate crisis the first thing you hear about? Headlines, radio programs, newspapers, you would never hear about anything else, as if there was a world war going on. Yet our leaders never talked about it." So Greta, as I remember that photo, she started skipping school on Fridays and going to the Swedish Parliament, which was conveniently near where she lived, and basically going on strike and saying, if the world's not doing hardly enough about climate change, then she's not going to go to school on Fridays. And of course, people told her to go to school. And of course, and one of her points was, well, why should I go to school if you're not going to give me a viable future? And so Greta has in turn inspired activists in other countries, including several in the U.S. And so this Friday, March 15th, they are planning a nationwide, worldwide, coordinated school strike. And so I think it'd be very interesting to see how many, you know, strikes there are and how many students. So this is from an essay that several of the organizers wrote. "We, the youth of America, are fed up with decades of inaction on climate change. On Friday, March 15th, young people like us across the U.S. will strike from school. We strike to bring attention to the millions of our generation who will most suffer the consequences of increased global temperatures, rising seas, and extreme weather. For decades, the fossil fuel industry has pumped greenhouse gas emissions into our atmosphere. 30 years ago, climate scientist James Hansen warned Congress about climate change. Now, according to most recent Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change report on global temperature rise, we have only 11 years to prevent even the worst effects of climate change. And that is why we strike. We strike because our world leaders haven't acknowledged, prioritized, or properly addressed the climate crisis. We strike because marginalized communities across our nation, especially communities of color and low-income communities, are already disproportionately impacted by climate change." And the authors of that article are 16, 13, and 12. And so I think it's interesting because the, you know, young folks, people under 30, certainly people under 25, don't know a world without climate change. And so those of us who are over 40, even those of us who are concerned, I think it's harder to sort of wrap our heads around that quite so much, as opposed to growing up and not knowing anything but, you know, Facebook and the internet and climate change. And so it's a very different mindset where, you know, the youth are becoming the leaders. And so what can we do besides rooting for Greta and the American students? Well, of course, we can take personal action to things like insulate our houses, drive less, fly less,
One of the easiest things, really, I think I realized, well, I knew this, but I realized it even more, is to eat less meat. And it doesn't mean you have to be a vegan, but even eating a little bit less meat, you know, reduces your impact on the earth. And somebody said recently, if 7 people go meatless one day a week, that's the same thing as one person going vegetarian. And so if one day a week meatless is what works for you, then that's good. Now, other people have pointed out that, you know, all this talk about individual actions, about eating less meat, you know, recycling, people criticizing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for taking a minivan to work. Yeah, but really, that doesn't matter, because your individual actions are not going to solve the climate crisis. It's not going to, that it has to be a worldwide coordinated action, you know, on the order of the New Deal, the 1930s, to address the Depression. You know, volunteer actions and charity from churches and nonprofit groups wasn't going to solve the Depression. You needed coordinated action of the New Deal. You know, individual actions and protests weren't going to stop, you know, the Nazis and Imperial Japan. You needed a coordinated worldwide action to stop their aggression. And so on one hand, those critics are correct that individual actions don't matter that much, but I think individual actions are important to show to ourselves and to others that, yes, you know, there is the possibility of putting solar on your roof, or driving a hybrid vehicle or an electric vehicle, or going meatless and still having a good life. And so I think those individual actions are useful and important to serve as examples, but certainly not enough. And one thing that we can do in Oregon, however, is encourage our legislators, and I sent this message out the day of my canceled service, about in Oregon is considering and may very well pass a clean energy jobs bill. It's, I mean, I like to think of it as sort of the Oregon mini Green New Deal, where Oregon will pass, it's a cap and invest program where Oregon will take about the 100 biggest polluting companies that operate in Oregon and have them and phase in a fee, not quite a tax, a fee on carbon emissions at $16 per ton of carbon dioxide, and cap how many tons of carbon dioxide those companies can pollute. And every year, that cap will decrease a little bit over time, and hopefully causing the price to go up. And so companies will have to bid on the available pollution credits, and the price will go up. And so companies will be encouraged to develop ways to pollute less, year by year. And this is a system that's being used in California and Quebec, and I believe in several countries in Europe, and also in 9 states on the East Coast have a similar system, and it works. Maybe not as fast as it should be working, but it works. And personally, the price of carbon maybe should be more like $160 a ton instead of 16, but I'll take 16. And so Oregon passing this bill and joining California and other places would be a great step, and something that we can participate in, encourage our legislators to pass a good clean energy jobs bill. And so one of the great things about this bill that is also sort of part of the Green New Deal is that that money would also be tied to clean energy projects, job training projects, providing funds for insulating houses in low-income communities, and so that the the focus of that money will not just be going to the general treasury, but will be targeted for specific projects, you know, starting off with low-income areas, rural communities that are hard hit by climate change, by pollution and forest fires, but also by, you know, the impacts on the industries that are being taxed. Well, it's not a tax. And so prioritizing those communities, it's sort of the smart thing to do, but also the right thing to do. And that sort of could be a great example for the federal Green New Deal, you know, when and if it moves ahead in some form or another, you know, a cap and trade system where the fees can be invested in communities is a great way to go. And, you know, a lot of people, including Mitch McConnell, have criticized the Green New Deal for being too ambitious. But of course, the response to that has been, you know, that kind of ambition is what's needed and comprehensive, you know, in the same way that the original New Deal was very ambitious and comprehensive, and way that the response to World War II was very comprehensive and ambitious. And so we need to focus our anger and turn it into ambition. Thank you.
We have a little space now for inviting us all into a spirit of meditation and prayer.